Welcome back to Iconography, a podcast dedicated to the geography of icons, real and imagined. This is the second half of a two-part series on Dunkirk, the French town that has a talismanic power in Britain. Last episode was a celebration of the fiction, a tapestry of Dunkirk as it has been imagined and interpreted. Their finest and atonement taught us that there's a certain mercy in fudging the truth. Mrs. Miniver, that there's overwhelming power in it. Call it propaganda, call it poetry, it can change the world. It can win wars. Maybe it can keep them locked in that mindset for longer than intended.
Most of those reaching back to the war are remembering not the conflict, but a mediated version of it, first produced for the big screen between the 1940s and the 1960s, and repeatedly broadcast on television in the decades that followed. This is the memory of a repeat of a fiction, and all the more powerful for the simplification it has undergone.
That's how I ended last episode, with a quote from historian Daniel Todman in an article about how Brexit-era Britain is drunk on Dunkirk spirit. The memory of a repeat of a fiction. That sentiment has become more prescient than I really could have expected in the past few weeks.
Donald Trump tweeting up a firestorm this morning defending the Confederate statues across the United States. Trump writes, quote, "Sad to see the history and culture of our great country being ripped apart with the removal of our beautiful statues and monuments. You can't change history, but you can learn from it. Robert E. Lee, Stonewall Jackson, who's next? Washington, Jefferson, so foolish," end quote.
Normally, I'm pretty coy when it comes to modern politics. If something on the front pages does come up in one of these episodes, like the refugee crisis in the Paddington episode or Brexit last episode, I've built up to it across the breadth of the episode and in the last few moments, hoping I've put forward enough historical evidence to support my view, I toss a little thought grenade out of the trench, dive back down, and hope I don't get hit by any shrapnel. This episode, I'm flipping the script. Literally. I'll open with what's on my mind and what's probably on yours. Charlottesville. I'm trying to think about Dunkirk, but I keep coming back to Charlottesville. Protests and counter-protests. Statues and symbols and stories. I'm naturally reticent about saying anything substantive in public. Often when something massive happens, I'll type up something on Facebook or Twitter, which in and of itself is like the most passive thing you can do, and I just stare at it and paralyzed by what will happen when it's out there in the world. I don't submit it. My thoughts are persistently frozen in draft. It probably sounds like I'm getting very far from Dunkirk. I have to confess, I'll do that a lot this episode. I'll be painting with a wide brush, taking in the whole of the Battle of France, what led to it, what came out of it. But let me lob this thought grenade right here at the top, and we'll see where it takes us. That paralysis is actually what Dunkirk and the surrounding Battle of France are all about. Call it what you will, appeasement, neutrality, complacency? Complicity? The Dunkirk spirit is a celebration of the people who came to Dunkirk. Yes, the pleasure yachters and stalwart fishermen, the shaken soldiers, the nurses, and also the crowds who welcome back their boys, celebrating a military defeat as if it were a miracle. But it's also implicitly a condemnation of the people who didn't come or couldn't come. The appeasers, the neutrals, the collaborators. There's been a lot of talk since neo-Nazis made such a forceful public showing in Charlottesville about how easy it is to condemn Nazis. This is not wrong. It is easy to condemn Nazis. This seemed to have been settled decades ago. In Germany, it is settled by law. Any show of outward sympathy to Nazism is a criminal act. Nazis were genocidal maniacs, cold-blooded killers who looked at every country they controlled as pure people they might keep alive if they behaved, and subhumans who needed to be exterminated. There is no defense for Nazism, no rational, level-headed way to say, well, maybe it's a hard no. Any whataboutism? What about Japanese internment? What about famine in India? The Allies were doing it too. Sounds insane. The Allies made some atrocious, indefensible decisions in their attempt to curb Axis influence, but I think we can all agree they were on the right side of their conflict with Nazis. Anyone who disagrees with that and who appropriates Nazi iconography is certainly guilty of seeing certain classes of human as subhuman. And possibly guilty of aiming to act on that vision. See? That was easy. Nazis condemned. If only it had always been so. There's been a lot of, our grandparents and great-grandparents found it easy to punch Nazis going around. But if all the non-Nazis of the world had been able to agree at the same time that Nazis needed punching, we probably wouldn't think as much about the Nazis today. The reason it's so easy to condemn Nazis now, we fought them for years and years and suffered many casualties, which has led to decades of scholarship that's explored exactly what they stood for. That's all because there was a time when it wasn't so easy to condemn Nazis.
This morning, I had another talk with the German Chancellor, Herr Hitler. And here is the paper which bears his name upon it as well as mine.
Learning about the 1930s is like watching that scene in a horror movie when someone says, come on, there's nothing going on here, I'm going to go check out that house. You're willing them not to do it, hoping this is the time they hear you and come to their senses, or bring a knife with them at least. Maybe they all go in at the same time this time, clobber the killer together. But they don't. Every time, one of them goes in the house alone, and the killer quickly washes the blood off his hands and emerges from the basement with a warm smile. And he either reassures the visitor, nothing untoward is going on here, everything's fine, or stabs the visitor. And this keeps repeating, visitor after visitor, until it's just Winston standing on the front porch alone, trying to reach Franklin and Joseph on the phone so they'll come join him and, you know, bring guns. Reading about the 1930s, you're willing the story to be different, so millions of lives will be saved, and the story never changes. When all the signatories of the Treaty of Versailles realize that the new German Führer is violating the treaty and rearming the German military in 1935, you hope that someone will listen to the rightly worried French who have to live next door to these guys and enforce what was agreed in 1918. It never happens, no matter how much you hope. Instead, the British take the lead and say, guys, it's fine. That treaty was way too hard on Germany. Let them feel a little powerful again. And then, when the Nazis, feeling sufficiently powerful, take the Rhineland and annex Austria in 1936 and 1937 respectively, you're praying there's a Captain von Trapp among the world leaders who will stand up to the Nazis.
I know you share this love. I pray that you will never let it die.
Your prayers are never answered. The story always ends with the von Trapps fleeing, doesn't it? And when Hitler tells Prime Minister Neville Chamberlain with a straight face at the Munich Conference of 1938 that he only wants the part of Czechoslovakia that German speakers live in, he would never take the rest of the country. You desperately need this to be the time that Chamberlain sees a tell, maybe a twinge of that Charlie Chaplin mustache into a tiny sneer. Something that lets him see the liar underneath. The French are ready to go. They want to defend their Czech ally. Come on, let them off the leash, Neville.
We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister, have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries.
He never does.
And for Europe.
No matter how many times you revisit the life of Neville Chamberlain, he always trusts the Nazis until it's too late. Even then, even once his trust is betrayed and Hitler moves on the rest of Czechoslovakia, can't he declare war on them then, you plead? Chamberlain knows their next target is Poland. He's so certain of it, he draws a line in the sand and says, if you attack Poland, we're, like, totally at war. But instead of acting on that knowledge, he waits. And Hitler calls his bluff in September of 1939, and guess what? No one's in Poland to defend Poland but the Poles. Guess how that turns out. So the Czechs were ready to fight, but were told by the appeasers to stand down. The Poles had an outstanding fighting force that fought outstandingly, but stood no chance with no support. At this point, with Britain and France officially at war with Germany, though not really interested in launching any sort of offensive, if all the rest of the countries out there, Norway, the Netherlands, Belgium, to name a few, if they all team up, they can go all inglorious bastards on some Nazis. Come on, you beg. This time you guys can do it. But history has already been written. The leaders of the Netherlands, Belgium, Norway, Sweden, Finland, and Denmark do team up to find a nonviolent solution. Ugh. King Leopold III of Belgium declares,
a great new power, a moral and spiritual power capable of arousing world opinion through the union of the small states. Let the conscience of the world awake.
It's weird. This isn't me. If someone said that to me 10 years ago about Iraq, I'd be like, amen. But Nazis short-circuit all that wiring. They're the villains it's okay to kill in video games. They're the menace that makes neutrality look morally repugnant. This is a strange position to be in. We are trained to be wary of war hawks who want to push a neutral country to fight. If there's a character like that in a movie, someone who says, we have to hit them before they hit us, and urges the president to hit the button, they're probably going to end up being part of some evil conspiracy, right? I even feel awkward in the military history section of Barnes & Noble, the section with books glorifying the soldiers of Dunkirk and D-Day that's always just as big, if not bigger, than the section called History. As I stand surrounded by the kinds of books I imagine someone's Republican uncle really wants to recommend to me, I'm reminded of that gem from Francois Truffaut. There's no such thing as an anti-war film. Essentially, even when a film thinks it's decrying war, whether it be a Hollywood epic or a History Channel documentary, it's really valorizing war in the very act of depicting it. We're supposed to feel icky about that. I may be reading modern society wrong, but that's society's default setting, right? No one wants to be at war if there's nothing substantial to war about. It's in everyone's best interest to let cooler heads prevail, not do anything rash, find a nonviolent solution. In any other context, this quote from Neville Chamberlain would be downright inspiring.
I am myself a man of peace to the depths of my soul. Armed conflict between nations is a nightmare to me. But if I were convinced that any nation had made up its mind to dominate the world by fear of its force, I should feel that it must be resisted. Under such a domination, life for people who believe in liberty would not be worth living. But war is a fearful thing, and we must be very clear before we embark on it, that it is really the great issues that are at stake, and that the call to risk everything in their defense, when all the consequences are weighed, is irresistible. For the present, I ask you to await, as calmly as you can, the events of the next few days. As long as war has not begun, there is always hope that it may be prevented, and you know that I am going to work for peace to the last moment. Good night.
Maybe if we were dealing with any man but Hitler, Chamberlain would have become an icon of peace. But Hitler was one of a kind. Even most higher-ups in the German ranks thought Hitler was nuts for going after Czechoslovakia. If Britain had shown any strong resistance, any inclination they might do something about it, Hitler would have likely been removed from power. Would that have panned out? Who knows? But it just goes to show, at the moment where Chamberlain weighed the consequences and decided the bargaining table was the only correct option, the actual long-term nonviolent solution, Hitler deposed in 1938, might have happened if he'd fervently threatened to declare war on behalf of the Czechs and meant it. There's a very difficult moral calculus here, one I can't even begin to break down. I'm no good at calculus, and maybe I'm no better at morals. What I will point out is this. There's this odd moment where everything we think we know about hawkishness and dovishness goes out the window, and the roles we associate with liberalism and conservatism are upended. Where the true liberal position is to fight for human rights, even when that fight will have no direct benefit for you or your country. And where the true conservative position is to stay home and take care of your own because the fight will have no direct benefit for you or your country. We may conflate liberalism with pacifism, especially since Vietnam and Iraq, but in 1939 and in 2017, it's more likely to be the liberal who pushes for something to be done, even if it's violent, about the Nazi menace. And it is conservative to say they have the right to run their house as they see fit, so long as they don't directly affect us. Call it the punching a Nazi paradox. Liberals drew Captain America punching a Nazi on a comic book cover when that was still a daring political statement in America. Conservatives like Charles Lindbergh, yes, that Charles Lindbergh, countered with this.
I have been forced to the conclusion that we cannot win this war for England, regardless of how much assistance we send. That is why the America First Committee has been formed.
America wasn't alone in this. Here's Neville Chamberlain on Czechoslovakia.
However much we may sympathize with a small nation confronted by a big and powerful neighbor, we cannot in all circumstances undertake to involve the whole British Empire in war simply on her account. If we have to fight, it must be on larger issues than that.
After England and France did declare war on Germany, they hoped other countries would join them, but those countries insisted on remaining neutral. Belgium, with 900,000 troops that it would not mobilize unless provoked. The Dutch, whose Queen Wilhelmina scoffed at her neutral lawmakers.
By the spring of 1938, when Hitler invaded Austria, it was plain to me that German policy would result in a European catastrophe.
But her Dutch subjects were
quietly asleep on a pillow called neutrality. Shortly before the war, it was necessary for me to point out that Hitler had written a book and it might be of some use to examine its contents.
And then there was Norway, which was attacked in April 1940 and fell within the month.
The strict observance of neutrality by Norway has been a contributory cause to the sufferings to which she is now exposed, and to the limits to the aid which we can give her.
Winston Churchill likely had a few more speeches written up for Belgium or the Netherlands should they suffer a similar fate.
Blame should not be attached to us, but to the neutrals, and we should take every opportunity of bringing this up.
Every nation was playing a waiting game, and Winston Churchill was sick of it. A country might denounce a Nazi action, but they wouldn't back up that denunciation with troops unless they were directly attacked. Churchill was speaking specifically of Chamberlain in the wake of the Munich Agreement when he wrote,
England has been offered a choice between war and shame.
But he may as well have been indicting all of Europe.
She has chosen shame and will get war.
And so we get to May 10th, 1940, the day that Chamberlain, persuaded he no longer has the backing of his own party, steps down and Winston Churchill steps in to 10 Downing Street.
Winston Churchill, who has held more political offices than any living man, is now Prime Minister. He is a man without a party. For the last 7 years, he has sat in the House of Commons, a rather lonesome and often bellicose figure, voicing unheeded warnings of the rising tide of German military strength. Now, at the age of 65, Winston Churchill, plump, bald, with massive round shoulders, is for the first time in his varied career of journalist, historian, and politician, the Prime Minister of Great Britain. Mr. Churchill now takes over the supreme direction of Britain's war effort at a time when the war is rapidly moving toward Britain's doorstep.
One by one, potential allies had been picked off. Until now, the Nazis have a fighting force big enough to invade multiple countries in one day. Which they do, on May 10th. Unless the remaining powers have a really good plan, it may be too late.
Now imagine me in the Maginot Line.
As it turns out, the remaining powers have a really bad plan.
My life is fine. French girls make a fuss of me. I'm not French as you can see, but I know what they mean when they say wee-wee.
Have you ever had a bad first week at your job? One where, like, by Friday you're wondering how you'd ever thought this would be a good fit, if you should even come back on Monday? Well, it was probably nothing compared to what Winston Churchill went through starting May 10th, 1940. Winston Churchill had, like, the worst first week at his job. Day one, he steps into a maelstrom. By day five, one of his allies has surrendered, and he's receiving urgent middle-of-the-night phone calls from the leader of France claiming that all is lost. Day six, he flies to Paris and watches the French shoveling official documents into bonfires in anticipation of an inevitable invasion. By day seven, Brussels and Antwerp have fallen, meaning the whole of Belgium isn't far behind, and the Allied troops are in full retreat. It's not a very smooth onboarding program. May 10th is one of the craziest days in world history. Churchill's first day on the job, he has to go in affirming what miserable-looking Dutch officials have been hearing all day, that no, the RAF unfortunately cannot provide any air support to stop the Nazis from taking the Netherlands, because a major military operation is underway in Belgium, where the Nazis are also invading simultaneously. Belgium is where everyone is putting their money on May 10th. The country is much more prepared. Their 900,000 men are now officially in the fight. And, as it happens, they are not unfamiliar with German invasions.
Oh, Belgium put the kibosh on the Kaiser. Europe took the stick and made him torn.
It's impossible to overstate just how important World War I is to all of this. For all four major players involved, France, Germany, Belgium, and Britain, the memory of that world-shattering conflict just one generation past had prompted all that neutrality and appeasement, anything to avoid a repeat. And now that a new conflict was inevitable, the memory of that world-shattering conflict had everyone angling for a repeat. Because at least a German invasion through the heart of Belgium, with both camps settling in for a long stalemate, would be familiar. Both sides actually seemed more than happy to play their parts in a rematch. France had done everything possible to ensure one, actually. If Germany wanted to invade France, it would have to do it through Belgium, because the Maginot Line, impervious to tank fire and aerial bombings, now stood between Germany and France. Championed by Marshal Philippe Pétain, the savior of Verdun, certainly the most beloved man in France, the Maginot Line was a fortification that ran the entire length of the French-German border, supposedly impenetrable. It had underground railways to support movement. It was freaking air-conditioned. This was an important security blanket for a nation that had been traumatized by its proximity to Germany, not just in the 19-teens, but many times. In 1918, French Premier Georges Clemenceau had tried to make his allies understand why France was so adamant that Germany needed to be sanctioned back to the Stone Age by the Treaty of Versailles.
America is far away, unprotected by ocean. England could not be reached by Napoleon himself. You are sheltered, both of you. We are not.
It may not have been the Atlantic Ocean or the English Channel as fortifications go, but for France, Belgium made for a nice buffer. That may sound harsh to Belgium, but that is how the French leaders saw it. It was a place that wasn't France, where the Battle of France could take place. And that was the plan. All of King Leopold's Belgian troops and whatever Dutch troops could make it were supposed to fall back and meet the French army and the British Expeditionary Force, and together they would dig in their heels and stop the German invasion at the River Dyle in central Belgium. put up the barbed wire. Let's do this. For its part, German High Command seemed more than ready to play along. The initial German plan was to do exactly what the Allies expected them to do. Send as many men as possible through central Belgium to meet the multinational Allied forces. Some Ford thinkers were pointing out that there was a big gap between the end of the Maginot Line and central Belgium. It's called southern Belgium, and also Luxembourg. And hey, it might be kind of sneaky to push through there with new fast things that hadn't existed in 1914. But that didn't become the official plan until a German plane was downed in Belgium with the central Belgium plan on board. At that point, Germany decided to pretend that they were sticking with the original central Belgium plan, sending enough troops north to make it look really convincing, while secretly they were going with plan B. Lightning fast, push through the Ardennes and Sedan, dash for the coast on panzers, cut the Allied troops in half, and see if they could muster a counterattack. Blitzkrieg. You might be asking now, how did the Allies not know that the Germans were amassing an incredibly large force with tanks that was going to push through the one weak spot in their line? This practically undefended wilderness between an impenetrable fortification and the chosen front line of battle. And come to think of it, why was there a big gap there in the first place? Well, the thinking was that this area, the Ardennes, was a sort of natural fortification. The French commander, Maurice Gamelin, hedged everything on the fact that this heavily wooded area was impenetrable, if not to slow-moving infantry, then certainly to tanks. He was really wrong, guys. And he would no longer be French commander by May 20th, which is probably one of the more deserved firings in history. When the Belgians waved their arms in the air and said, "Hey, France, just warning you, the Germans are going to go through the Ardennes," Gamelin ignored them. The Swiss also pointed out that the Germans were crossing through Luxembourg and were also ignored. The Czechs had the actual German plans directly from a disgruntled German officer, Paul Thumel, and passed that intelligence to the British. And you can guess from the fact that Dunkirk happened that the British did not do anything especially intelligent with that intelligence. On May 13th, the Germans popped out of the forest, and within a few days they had polished off the much smaller French force that was defending Sedan. Now the mad dash for the English Channel was on. It's at this point, early in the morning on the 15th, Churchill sleeping off his first Tuesday in office and dreaming about his first Wednesday, that the French premier calls the British prime minister.
"We have been defeated," cries Paul Reynaud. "We are beaten. We have lost the battle."
Churchill reacts as you probably would have, a little bit groggy, with a chaser of,
"Come now, it can't be that bad."
So the Nazis broke through the line. So what? Throw the strategic reserve that's hanging out in France at this rampaging line of tanks. The Allies still have the bigger army, have barely suffered any casualties, and can certainly regroup. And that's precisely what Churchill says the next day when he flies into Paris and meets with the French.
"Tomorrow they will be in Paris. In Paris."
"Rubbish, you're talking nonsense."
This isn't Churchill, it's the main character in the 1958 Dunkirk film reacting to the collapse of the French, but it's the same general idea.
"They've broken through and the situation is bad, that's obvious. We all know that. We've all known it for days. But Gamelin must be getting his reserve into position by now."
"What reserve?"
"The strategic reserve, of course."
"When I was in Reims in February, the 7th Army was the heart of the strategic reserve. There was almost nothing else. Gamelin sent the 7th Army to Holland. What is there left?"
"But you can't mean that. The whole principle of the Maginot Line was to build up a strong reserve."
Churchill wants to know what the counterattack strategies are, how many strategic reserves troops there are, and the commander of the French forces, Maurice Gamelin, 4 days short of being relieved of duty, sends Churchill the shrug emoji.
There are none.
The next day, May 17th, Churchill and the commander of the British Expeditionary Force, Admiral Gort, both conclude, independently of one another, that it is time to draw up an evacuation plan. This is where your standard Dunkirk story kicks into gear. A troop of British soldiers in Belgium who have barely seen any action and haven't even gotten to their position yet receive a mysterious order to destroy their perfectly good equipment, leave it behind, and head for the coast, away from the Germans. Like these troops, you may be wondering, why? The Allies still have a very large force north of this thin thread that the Germans are sewing to Calais, and they have forces south of the Germans. It's not ideal, it's not the strategy you'd take in risk, but couldn't the forces meet at a pre-agreed location and snip? Or even just get enough guys north of the line to push south against whatever Germans are holding the line? The problem is that, unlike in Risk, where you can see the whole board and you have a godlike ability to move your troops where they need to be, the military commanders of 1940 had to find ways to communicate plans with one another and act on those plans. In spite of advances in telephone and radio, in 1940, a lot of this is still done by men whose job it is to run back and forth between camps. This communication gap is exacerbated by the Anglo-French cultural divide and by the thousands of refugees clogging the roads as they flee Belgium, and especially by the German advance, which of course cuts off what communication lines they do have. One of Churchill's emissaries to Paris, Edward Spears, despaired upon seeing how disorganized and unprepared the military leadership was.
"This war is madness. We have gone to war with a 1918 army against a German army of 1939.
All of this talk about the failure of that strategy isn't conjecture, by the way. On May 21st, Admiral Gort did try to snip the Germans at Arras. And he had some success. Britain had some killer tanks, and they essentially rampaged undamaged until they broke down of their own accord. But there wasn't time to muster a force large enough to break through and allow the Allies that critical route back into France. So now, the three remaining Allies, Belgium, France, and England, are all at increasingly dire stages of a game of chess that they seem certain to lose. Britain is in check, but the English Channel potentially gives them enough space to figure out how to avoid a future checkmate, if they can figure out how to get back across it. France has seen 10 moves ahead and has calculated that checkmate is coming. Belgium just heard Germany yell checkmate. All they can do is see whether Germany's right or not. All three have hard decisions to make. Do they fight on when doing so means losing troops for a valiant but foolhardy last stand and bringing civilians and cities into the vengeful Nazis' crossfire? Or do they get out whoever they can, troops at best, kings and politicians at worst, and fight on from somewhere that's not on the continent, which would mean remote African colonies or England for the French and Belgians? Or do they accept defeat and hope that if they surrender, the Nazis will be relatively merciful and spare the people that these leaders have vowed to protect? The decision each country made has had effects that have gone far beyond 1940 or 1945. You could argue that you wouldn't have Freedom Fries or Brexit without the weeks that surround Dunkirk.
Out from the hell that is Dunkirk, back from the steel thrust of the German war machine comes the BEF. They're worn out and footsore. They're hungry. For weeks they have been shelled and bombed from three sides. They had to stagger back to the sea to survive. They were betrayed, but never defeated or dispirited.
What we really talk about when we talk about Dunkirk is this. When it's right to start fighting, recall that pretty much everyone failed that test, and when it's right to stop. Last episode, I asked what you could learn about Dunkirk if you only had the monuments we've built to it, the movies, the books, the stories. You'd get quite a bit. I feel like you could put together a nice 10-minute presentation, particularly if you'd watch the 1958 film Dunkirk. But while you might be able to outline the significance of Sedan or the Maginot Line, it would be much easier to describe the beach at Dunkirk, not the town of Dunkirk. There's a town, you might wonder if you've seen movies about Dunkirk. No, the beach. The feeling of it, the sound of oncoming planes, the sand flying as soldiers duck into dunes for cover, the groan of a ship as it sinks, and the sounds of screams as people jump into the water. the steely determination of sweater-clad civilians on fishing boats who've come to save the day. These are icons, statues in our mind and on cinema screens, that memorialize the Dunkirk spirit, that ineffable mix of military and civilian cooperation on the front line.
So long as the English tongue survives, the word Dunkirk will be spoken with reverence,
trumpeted the New York Times.
For in that harbor, the rags and blemishes that have hidden the soul of democracy fell away. There, beaten but unconquered, in shining splendor, Britain faced the enemy.
The English tongue. How infuriating must that be? It's not inaccurate, but it must be so grating to the people who know Dunkirk by its non-anglicized spelling. D-U-N-K-E-R-Q-U-E. The French do not, as a general rule, like Dunkirk. Not the town, of course. The town is fine. No, the legend, the event, the saga. Can you blame them? Dunkirk is French. The people there speak French, and daily they embody their own Dunkirk spirit. The spirit of the people who live there and work there. The world's notion of Dunkirk as a beach overflowing with British pluck, a totemic pillar of Britishness, that notion is completely divorced from the reality. That Dunkirk is as French as Venice Beach is Italian.
Anglo-Saxons have an unpleasant tendency to put forward defeats of the British army and pass off as those of the French army.
That's Gary Assouline of HuffPost France criticizing Chris Nolan's monument to Dunkirk. Nolan's film has come in for quite a drubbing in France. Not so much as a movie, everyone agrees it's tense and evocative, but as history.
No one can deny a director's right to focus his point of view on what he sees fit, as long as it does not deny the reality of that which it claims to represent,
argues Jacques Mandelbaum in Le Monde.
Where in the film are the 120,000 French soldiers who were also evacuated from Dunkirk? Where are the 40,000 who sacrificed themselves to defend a city against a superior enemy in weaponry and numbers?
Contrary to popular belief, the Nazis did not march directly into Paris. They were met immediately and frequently by French forces who fought ferociously to protect their country. The French fatality rate per week during the Battle of France was 6 times higher than it was during World War I. Why don't we talk about this more? Why do we always fall back on the stereotype of the French as giving up?
You countryless, crass Americans! We hate all of you! The Germans are here. Hello, Americans! I love you! Come on, Americans! Hello! Welcome back, Americans! Now come, you can build a Disneyland near Paris. We won't go, but build it.
The Dunkirk spirit is not a one-way street. Inflating the stock of the average Brit with their back against the wall has an effect on the rest of the market. Whether it's fair or not, the Dunkirk spirit lowers the stock of everyone else. Everyone who wasn't there. The Poles, Czechs, Norwegians, and Dutch who couldn't stand the fight long enough to be there. The Americans and Russians who didn't have the foresight to know they should be there. And, most crucially, the Belgians and the French, whose collapse supposedly necessitated the evacuation in the first place. There is an implicit condemnation in the celebration.
We had to pull together a miracle because you failed us. And then we held out long enough to save all of you.
You're welcome. Ha! I guess it's just my way of being me.
And that has proved to be an extremely intoxicating brew. Remember that Daniel Todman quote from the top of the episode? Brexit is essentially what happens when Britain is drunk on Dunkirk spirit. Dunkirk isn't the origin of Britain's we-can-go-it-alone spirit, but it certainly is the most leafed-through story on that shelf. Here are some things that people actually said in the wake of France's surrender in late June 1940. The future Prime Minister Anthony Eden reported to his king, George VI,
"Now we are all alone, sir. We haven't an ally left."
You would expect him to say this somberly, but no. He was clarifying why he seemed so giddy. The king didn't disagree. He told his mother,
"Personally, I feel happier now that we have no allies to be polite to or pamper."
This sentiment was prevalent. An American journalist leaving France with a group of British journalists observed,
"They almost seemed happy. They were British and their course was clear. They were sticking together now."
Privately, the British rejoiced at finally being able to run the war their way, the British way. But publicly, the British used the French to cover for their own issues, scorning their now former allies for their weakness, their cowardice. Just as the French and British had tag-teamed in scorning the Belgians after Belgium's April 28th surrender. As you can tell, there was more than a tiny bit of acting the victim in this. It's sort of like when an athlete takes a small hit and then flops to the ground as if they've just been sucker punched.
Because that's just a regular foul. I don't care what year it is. I don't care what era you're playing basketball.
But you are indicating that LeBron may be play acting.
It's a bit of a lie, but if it helps you win the game. What I'm getting at is, fake news isn't anything new. When Leopold III of Belgium finally threw in the towel after weeks of defending the perimeter as Britain and France did whatever it was they were doing, it wasn't news to his allies. A, they had to have seen this coming. And B, if they didn't see it coming, Leopold told them a day in advance that it was coming.
"The Belgian army has totally exhausted its capacity for resistance," he wrote. "Its units are incapable of renewing the struggle tomorrow."
Leopold, a man of honor who worshipped his war hero father and was probably the least likely man to ever work with Nazis, elected to remain in Belgium to suffer the same fate as his people rather than fleeing to England or Africa to continue the struggle. Accordingly, since he was unable to defend himself, the French promptly threw him under the bus, blaming him for their piss-poor showing thus far. Paul Reynaud shrieked,
"It is monstrous! Absolutely monstrous! There has never been such a betrayal in history!"
Okay. He claimed that Belgium had given in
without warning its French and English fellow combatants, thus opening the road to Dunkirk to German divisions.
A flamboyant, dramatic lie, if ever there was one. Behind the scenes, Gamelin's replacement as French commander, Maxime Weygand, was actually relieved.
"We now shall be able to lay the blame for defeat on the Belgians."
This lie took work. The French blackmailed Belgian politicians who had fled to France into backing up their story, saying they couldn't ensure the safety of Belgian refugees unless Leopold was decried as having treated with the enemy. And the French elbowed the British until they joined in too. You probably know this part of Churchill's famous June 4th speech.
"We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender."
But this part about Leopold doesn't get as much play.
"Suddenly, without prior consultation, he surrendered his army and exposed our whole flank and means of retreat. Had not this ruler and his government severed themselves from the Allies, had not they sought refuge in what has proved to be a fatal neutrality, the French and British armies might well at the very outset have saved not only Belgium, but perhaps even Poland."
These are lies. Lies meant to keep the populace going. In the same speech that Churchill praises his people for pulling through at Dunkirk, he damns everyone else for bringing it about. It worked. This is sound strategy, but very unsound history. Leopold was vindicated later in June thanks to the persistence of one Roger Keyes, who filed a suit to counter the libel that Leopold had given no warning about his country's surrender. But it didn't matter. The government made sure that the BBC didn't report on Leopold's vindication, and the historical narrative has largely continued to reflect the initial lie. The irony is that at the same time France and Britain were throwing Leopold to the wolves for giving up the fight, these two countries were considering doing exactly that. The same day that Leopold wrote to his allies to inform them of his imminent surrender, April 27th, Operation Dynamo was underway. This was an evacuation from Dunkirk that the British had commenced without informing their allies that they were leaving. And back in London, Churchill was trying to keep his foreign minister, Lord Halifax, from resigning, a move which likely would have been a death blow to Churchill's weeks-old government. Halifax insisted that with Belgium and France on the verge of collapse and with only a few thousand BEF troops likely to be evacuated before the Germans closed in, it was high time to recruit Mussolini to set up peace talks with Hitler. Churchill was trying to hold him at bay and convince the remaining members of his war cabinet, including a dying Neville Chamberlain, to bet on Britain's military strength. Over in Paris, pretty much the same discussions were taking place. Marshal Pétain, the savior of Verdun and champion of the Maginot Line, had been brought in as vice premier, a stabilizing influence, a reminder of past glories, of victory over Germany. He and Weygand, the French commander, were in favor of saving lives by signing an armistice. The premier, Paul Reynaud, wanted to honor the agreement with Britain and keep up the fight. Pétain spat,
"The interests of France come before those of Britain. Britain got us into this position. Let us not try to get out of it."
Okay. Gamelin and the French did plenty to get themselves in this position, too, but as wrong as Pétain will be about many things, he's not necessarily wrong about this. Remember, it was Britain that persistently appeased Hitler, claiming the Treaty of Versailles was unfair and France was being paranoid. France was not being paranoid, as it turns out. Americans think of France in the Jazz Age as like peak world culture. But in truth, the Treaty of Versailles had done almost as much damage to France as it had done to Germany. One of the reasons Americans flocked to Jazz Age Paris was because it was cheap. We've largely bought into the British line of thinking, that the Treaty of Versailles was too harsh, that it wrecked the German economy, and that Hitler rose to power on the wings of resentment. And yes, Germany's economy went into a freefall. But Germany was supposed to be paying reparations to France, and those stopped coming in. France asked, guys, can we enforce the treaty? And Britain was like, no. This caused as much instability in France as it did in Germany. Between 1932 and 1939, France was so unstable that 19 different governments came and went in 7 years. The one thing that seemed to go right in France was military spending. Fearing the Nazis long before anyone else did, France spent and spent and spent. Tanks, planes, the vaunted Maginot Line. It got to the point that the French army dwarfed the British army by the time war broke out. Seeing the relatively paltry support England was providing, the French ambassador to the UK deadpanned,
"The English have such confidence in the French that they are tempted to consider their military support as a gesture of solidarity rather than a vital necessity."
And as France faltered in May and June of 1940, England continued to be stingy about RAF and troop support. Henry Pownall, former chief of staff of the BEF, broke it down thusly.
"There is a very difficult balance to be held. If the French are going to crack and we have got to fight it out for ourselves, as is extremely probable, we do not want to waste our resources, especially air resources, in a fruitless way to sustain them. On the other hand, there is always the chance that the French, or part of them, will hold out sufficiently long if we help them to enable us to come to their aid and stop the rot."
Churchill desperately wanted the latter to be true. He sent in a second BEF under the command of Alan Brooke and told him to
"make the French feel we are supporting them."
Brooke replied that it is
impossible to make a corpse feel.
This, right here, is the popular image of France to this day, as useful as a dead fish when a battle breaks out. This most obviously flared up at the start of the Iraq War, when Americans were so infuriated that France refused to fight that they renamed French fries Freedom Fries.
Ambassador Pierre Vimont recalls being taken aback at the depth of the anger.
The Freedom Friars, etc., we thought that it was a bit too much to some extent. We understood the frustration because of the difference we had, but we thought that our position was an honorable one, and we stick to that.
But that spite was building on an already prevailing notion of the French as cowards waving a white flag in surrender. And that notion really gained traction right here in 1940 with Gamelin, Weygand, and Pétain. There are no streets in France today named after Marshal Philippe Pétain. There were once many. After Verdun, there were Pétain avenues and Rue Pétain everywhere. Not just in France, everywhere. In America, too. Pétain received a ticker tape parade in New York in 1931, a world hero. There's a plaque there that commemorates Pétain and his parade. It might not be there for much longer. After the events in Charlottesville, New York Mayor Bill de Blasio announced that he would put together a committee that would assess whether each of New York's monuments, memorials, statues, and plaques deserved to stay up. It was a bit of a blunder. That committee would be working for a very long time, and when they were done, there might not be any memorials left in New York. But de Blasio knew that there were some remembrances out there that needed to be re-remembered. He'd already made one decision without the committee. That Pétain plaque would be the first thing to come down. This is not because Marshal Pétain surrendered to the Nazis. There's nothing wrong with surrendering. If fighting on is not a valid option, and ceasing the fight saves lives. And that's what Pétain's armistice of June 22, 1940 seemingly did. At first. France lost its northern half to German occupation, but it got to remain France, and it set up a new seat of government in Vichy, and it was at peace. But then, because these were the Nazis, it became harder and harder to be a head of state who was at peace with the Nazis, and who wanted to remain at peace with the Nazis, and to be a head of state who preserved lives. Compromises were made here and there. Little ones at first, but it wasn't long before they were giant compromises. Compromises that should have made peace in France impossible because French citizens were dying. Concentration camp compromises.
Paris. Paris outragé. Paris brisé. Paris martyrisé. Mais Paris. Libéré par lui-même, libéré par son peuple avec le concours.
Charles de Gaulle had idolized Philippe Pétain, named his first son after him. The once obscure French general who had fled to England in June 1940 and somehow persuaded Winston Churchill to recognize him as the leader of the real France, free France, fulfilled his promise. Now, in 1945, he watched as the marshal was sentenced to death for treason. A lot of streets were renamed, and a lot of mothers and fathers wished they could rename their sons as well. There are still those who want to preserve some or all of the legacy of Philippe Pétain. The last street in France named after Pétain was renamed in 2011. Some of the folks who wanted to keep the last Rue Pétain intact thought, look, it had been decades, and changing the name doesn't change what happened.
It is ridiculous, a resident complained to the New York Times. Clearly he was a traitor in the Second World War, but these things happened decades ago. It is not good to think like that.
Others believe Pétain is misunderstood. The New York Times also spoke to a member of the Association for the Defense of the Memory of Marshal Pétain, who believes that without Pétain,
no one, not even the Jews, would have been spared. In 1940, since the government was incapable of acting in the face of chaos, the first who came among the people and the politicians was Pétain. Then all the mistakes were dumped on him.
And, of course, even though none of them spoke to the New York Times about it in 2011, there are certainly people out there who support any Rue Pétain because Pétain stands for France without Jews. France has made its decision about Philippe Pétain in spite of these holdouts. And it is a decision, a choice. For 5 years in the 1940s, there were two Frances, one led by Pétain, the other led by Charles de Gaulle. France has chosen to honor de Gaulle's France, and it has chosen not to honor Pétain's. Pétain's France hasn't been erased. Here it is in this podcast episode right now. But just as there are no statues of Hitler in Berlin outside the confines of museums, there are no grand monuments to Pétain in Paris, even though he saved France in 1918. Monuments are not history. Philippe Pétain still saved France in 1918. That happened. Whether or not a plaque says Philippe Pétain had a ticker tape parade in New York in 1931, he did. The confetti cannot unfall. Events cannot change, but our perceptions of them can. There's this sense that history is most accurate when you can ask everyone who was there what happened, and as events pass from living memory, the history of those events devolves into conjecture and archaeology. But, I don't know, the people who lived it, they misremember facts, right? They intentionally obfuscate the truth for a multitude of reasons. They invent a more idealized reality. As the last survivors of Dunkirk live out their final years, we lose the flavor of the day-to-day, the chance to say, "I never thought to ask you, but what was the look on your commander's face when he gave the retreat order?" and get an answer. But we continue to learn more facts, and we will continue to do so. In 1958, the public did not know that Admiral Bertram Ramsay conducted Operation Dynamo from the underground tunnels beneath the White Cliffs of Dover. Because the tunnels were a secret, they were meant to house the remnants of Britain in case the Cold War turned very, very hot. Accordingly, in the 1958 film made about Dunkirk, a public memorial to a country-defining event, Admiral Bertram begs for more ships from a spacious, sunlit room that probably overlooks the English Channel. This is wrong, but it isn't a lie. The filmmakers didn't know any better, so they made a guess. Up until 2010, the public did not know about a draft document in which Philippe Pétain took an anti-Semitic policy and marked all over it to make it more anti-Semitic. If someone memorialized Pétain as a man who made bad decisions for the right reasons before 2010, maybe that wasn't a lie. We didn't know any better. But if, in 2017, when you can go visit the underground tunnels in Dover, you film a scene where you have Bertram running Operation Dynamo from a sunlit room, or if, in a world where you can view that document that Pétain revised, you build a new statue of Pétain and write, "He was an honorable man who only wanted to save lives." If you do those things, then you're ignoring facts. I kind of think that, if you break it down, every country, every city, every religion, every group of people that feel connected to each other by an ideology, they're truly being held together by a set of facts that they've chosen to ignore. Maybe for so long that they've forgotten the facts they were ignoring. For example, a healthy share of British identity, owing as much as it does to victory in World War II and the Dunkirk spirit, requires the erasure of tens of thousands of brave French troops who died in 1940. And look, I'm not saying it's sinister or even intentional at this point. What it is a memory of a repeat of a fiction. But that doesn't mean we stop trying to reinsert the facts. like historians of recent vintage who have sought to change the perception of French and Belgian contributions to the Battle of France, historians like Daniel Todman and Lynn Olson. We keep trying so we can honor those facts and not the memory of the repeat of a fiction. We raise the facts so high in the sky and wave them like a flag so we know that anyone who ignores them, who chooses the memory, the repeat, or the fiction over the truth, must be doing so for their own unscrupulous reasons.